Osiris.
Folks, David Goldstein.
I am Brian Brinkman.
You're listening to a special bonus episode of the Beyond the Pond podcast. Generally speaking, this is a podcast in which Brian and myself utilize the music of Phish as a means of introducing the listener to other music. Because we love Phish, we are Phish fans. The problem with Phish fans is they get myopic, as you are well aware. They can recount dates, set lists, favorite songs, favorite jams, everything revolving around their favorite band. But then you say, hey man, what'd you think about the latest album from the band Wild Beasts? And they'll say, what the hell are you talking about, like Wild Beast on Lot? And you say, no man, we're trying to do something about that.
We absolutely are. And if you guys joined us last month as we started our countdown of our 10 favorite records of each year of the decade, we did 2010. We're now into 2011. We're counting down our 10 favorite records of this year, talking a little bit about them, what we remember from when they came out, who were as listeners at the time, and kind of working our way towards the end of the 2010s. What a decade it has been. In wow, we both became dads, and the world may be, who we don't know. There's still 11 months left in the year as of recording. I guess 8 months left in the year when this publishes, or nine or something like that. The world could end is my point. We have no idea what's going to happen. So I hope it doesn't.
Yeah, hope it doesn't.
It's been quite an intense decade. So jumping into 2011 here, Dave, what do you remember about music, about kind of where you were as a fan of music and just kind of as a person in 2011?
Goodness, I don't recall much about 2011, except that I only saw one Phish show in 2011. 12:30 2011. Good Piper, not a very good show. I remember I had wanted to go to Bethel Woods, but instead I went to my cousin. She got married that weekend up in Northampton. She was a Smith graduate. I remember walking around Northampton, going to some nice craft beer bars, and walking around the Smith University campus, Smith College campus. But otherwise, aside from the fact that looking at my list, most of these bands I still listen to, and most of them still exist in some form, I can't remember shit about 2011.
I remember I had, for the first 4 months of the year, the worst job I've ever had. And then I transitioned into a much better job, cooking at a really cool restaurant in Portland, met some awesome people, met Brian Lee Weaver this year, the chef at Butcher and Bee, who's one of our close friends. Ran my first marathon in 2011 and just kind of got settled in the Pacific Northwest, which is where I thought I was going to live from the start of the year until at least the very end of the year. I thought I was going to stay there and probably for much longer. We were pretty happy in Portland, even though my wife and I made no money and lived in a tiny, tiny one-bedroom apartment. But we had each other. We had a dog, and we biked everywhere. And I listened to a lot of music. I only saw two Phish shows that year. I saw the two Gorge shows because Phish just kind of decided in 2011 to not really tour the West Coast and definitely not really tour the Northwest.
I actually visited Portland, Oregon in 2011, so I could have passed you on the street.
That's very, very strange. I would have loved to have gone back in time and seen our faces, knowing that we were about to start a podcast.
I remember I went to Clyde Common, had some nice cocktails. Goodness, what else did I do in Portland? Went to Pock Pock, of course. We drove up the coast to go to Cannon Beach, and we were eating blackberries from a blackberry bush. I had a fun time in Portland. went to, what is that brewery? Upright Brewing, which I remember was in like the basement of some futuristic building right across the street from the Rose Garden. And you walked into the building. It was on a weekend. It looked totally abandoned. You go down an elevator, and there's like a swinging tap room. And you're like, oh, okay, this isn't a secret. People know about it. So, yeah, that was the last time I was in Portland, Maine, was 2011. Portland, Oregon. Portland, Oregon. Anyhow, jumping in to what my top 10 albums were in that year. Again, I took this list from, I talked about last bonus episode, I wrote for a website called Coke Machine Glow. We had year-end features, so it was still posted. So I just took my 10 from where I was at in 2011. So my number 10 was The Horrors, Skying. Horrors are a British rock band. A lot of people kind of refer to as record collector rock because they draw from like the best of post-punk, the best of shoegaze. Some of their stuff kind of sounds like John Hughes soundtracks from the 80s. I know this album had a very like John Hughes sort of like Tears for Fears, Aha sheen to it, especially the big single Still Life, which was a fantastic song. But yeah, The Horrors are kind of like a band I mentioned in the last episode, Foals, in that they're, I think they're on their fifth album, and they've actually been a pretty unique, pretty successful British rock band over the past 10 years. And I know their album that came out in 2009, being Primary Colors, is one of my favorite albums of the past 15 years. Still their best record. If you enjoy post-punk and shoegaze and think that you might enjoy what Dave Goldstein listens to, get Primary Colors by The Horrors. Holy shit. But this was a very good follow-up record.
So my number 10 is a record that I have a slight bit of regret for this being on my list now. This has definitely fallen off of my listening over the last 9 years, and I really haven't connected in any way of any of this artist's music since then, aside from I think his record in 2016, and that's James Blake's debut album, self-titled. I absolutely loved, and I still love, the EPs that he released throughout 2010, and I remember there was a ton of anticipation and hype going into this record being released. I think it was released in February or January at some point. It was definitely a winter release, and it definitely sounds like winter in the Pacific Northwest. Definitely some moments on it that I still like, and when I revisited it a couple weeks ago, I found myself, you know, definitely being brought into the overall songwriting, but it's not one of my favorite records by a long shot as the decade has continued. But definitely listened to this a lot in 2011, and it hung around there in my top 10.
I hate James Blake. Sorry.
I kind of figured that.
So I have for my number 9, somewhat controversial record, The Strokes. The album is called Angles. This is the fourth Strokes album, supposedly recorded under duress, as in which is to say, I guess the band would send instrumentals to Julian Casablancas, and he would record vocals differently when they weren't in the same room, and it was supposedly a pretty stressful way to make like 35 minutes of music. But I think this album is great. It has one of my very favorite Strokes songs in the opening track, Machu Picchu. And it's kind of a way for the Strokes to move forward. It has a bunch of rinky-dink 80s keyboards, but all the hooks are intact. And I think it's actually a much better album than the third Strokes album, First Impressions of Earth. Album's kind of been forgotten by history. I mean, when it comes down to the Strokes, only the first two albums are essential. Everything else is kind of just like window dressing for hardcore fans, almost kind of like Oasis, in the sense that so long as they just play the first two records, they can headline festivals for the next 25 years. But I think Angles is underrated, overlooked, and I think if you went back and heard it, you would be pleasantly surprised.
So my number 9 is the first of two appearances by this artist here as his alter ego, The Caretaker. An Empty Bliss Beyond This World. And this is an album that we talked about, and I had no idea what Beyond the Pond episode. That's how far we've got into this thing that I just forget when we feature this stuff. But this is a record Leland Kirby, the artist behind The Caretaker, basically took old records from the 30s and 40s, like dancehall, slower classical music, and slowed it down, repeated specific moments in it, kind of in this very drony way, as a way of kind of commenting on Alzheimer's and the sense of memory loss and memory kind of weaving in and out of our consciousness. And it just, the concept of it really fascinated me. It fit really well into the drone ambient type of music that I was listening to at the time, which you'll hear some more of throughout the rest of this list. But this is definitely a record that felt like a moment in time for me, but I've gone back and re-listened to it, and it's kind of one of those albums I can live in. It doesn't really have like singles or songs per se. It's just like one full piece that I like.
So for my number 8 album, it's Toon Yards, Who Kill. Toon Yards, of course, being the one-woman project of Meryl Garbus. I think actually the bass player is now an official member of Toon Yards as of their most recent album, I Can Feel You Creep Into My Private Life, which I didn't think was terribly good, unfortunately. But this album, Who Kill, is awesome. I remember when I first heard the first single off of this album, Business, which is, I think, still one of the best Toon Yards songs to date, I did a double take. I'm like, what the hell is that? This is like an update on like classic Talking Heads, kind of like shot through with some really awesome samples and snapping beats and lyrics. Just an exemplary song, had a really great video as well. And this whole album to me is the best Toon Yards experience. And the one she put out after that, Nicky Knack, was pretty good. And like I said, I don't love the most recent one, but this is a pure, unadulterated Toon Yards. You know, she plays the drums, then she loops the drums. She has the bass player. It's just, if you're not familiar with it, I think that you should be, especially if you are a fan of Afrobeat and the Talking Heads.
So my number 8 is, I want to say the final album from this band.
Yeah, they're done. Yeah.
I think it is. They're done. This is Girls with Father, Son, Holy Ghost. The lead track off of this album is one of the best songs I've heard of the decade. It's one of the happiest songs I've ever heard. And the record itself, it's just, Girls was a perfect encapsulation of like blog rock in the early 2010s. They had an EP and an album titled, I believe, Album, that came out in 2009 or 2010. And they were kind of like here and then just gone. And this record, I think, is the best one that they made. It's their most accomplished. It is filled front to back with really catchy riffs, really catchy songs. Kind of falls in line with like the Brooklyn early 2000s scene. But then you've got songs like Vomit that are like 7 minutes and just filled with ridiculously big guitar solos. And this definitely fit a mold for me in the early 2010s that I absolutely loved. And I think this album is still holds up. I've listened to it recently, and it's still a really good snapshot of this band and what they were capable of. And I wish we could have heard a couple other albums from them, though I don't know how great they would have been just knowing how much they put into the first few records.
So for my number 7, I've got Florence and the Machine, Ceremonials. This was their second album. The first one, Lungs, is the one that has probably Florence's best-known song, The Dog Days Are Over. I think Ceremonials is the better album in every way. Chris Martin would cut off every last lock of his hair to have a song as big and uplifting, as expansive as the first single, Shake It Out. This was kind of established Florence the Machine is a pretty serious band that was willing to take some leaps You know, she's a vibrant singer. She's got a huge set of pipes. And I don't know where they recorded this record, but it kind of sounds like it was recorded in like a gigantic abandoned church, all the stained glass. She could just blow it out and shatter the stained glass, as it were. I know this album was produced by Paul Epworth, who was indie rock producer who would go on to produce Adele and become super famous doing that. Before then, he produced like Block Party and all these mid-2000s block bands. This was kind of the start of him producing more expansive, like British divas, so to speak. But yeah, this is a very good record. It holds up. The ones you put it after this one, How Big, How Beautiful, How Blue. No, How Big, How Blue, How Beautiful. I forget exactly. That's also pretty good. I was bored to death by her most recent album, the name of which I cannot even recall. But yeah, Ceremonials, good record.
Yeah, this record was kind of everywhere in spring 2011, I want to say. I remember enjoying it quite a bit when it first came out.
Yeah, it's got some great songs. It's I still think it's your peak album.
So my number seven is a record that I think Dave's going to talk about a little bit later. This is an artist we both love a lot. It's Kurt Vile, Smoke Ring for My Halo. So I first heard of Kurt Vile about a year and a half earlier and loved Childish Prodigy, the record that came out in, I think, 2009. This was definitely glossier. Was this his first record for Matador?
No, I think Childish Prodigy was.
Okay. This one, there's definitely more studio trickery throughout this. It's much prettier around the edges, much softer. It definitely gets into domestic commenting and talking about his life as, I don't know if he was a dad yet at this point in time, but he was definitely inching towards that. I saw him a couple of times on this tour, and these songs just came through really well from a live standpoint. I listened to this record just prior to recording, and it's a beautiful album. It's probably the prettiest record he's made, and well, I think I like Waking on a Pretty Days more than you did. I definitely think that there's an argument to be made that this is his strongest release until Bottle It In, but I don't know. I love this album, and I definitely feel like this kind of pointed the way forward in a really unique way for Kurt Vile, away from the garage and a little bit more into singer-songwriter, kind of commenting on the world in his own unique way.
This album rules, and I'll have more to say about it later. So, for my number six, White Denim, D. This is the best White Denim album.
Yes.
I think it probably has what was the best White Denim lineup. It was the ones who've remained steady in the band was frontman James Petrali, bass player Steve Terabecki. But at this time, they also had second guitarist Austin Jenkins and the drummer Josh Block, both of whom Jenkins and Block have since moved on. Now they are like the rhythm section for the soul singer. Oh, God, what's his name? Austin Jenkins and Josh Block. They left White Denim kind of to perform a bit of a rhythm/production team. I know they're the backing band for the modern soul singer Leon Bridges. They also did some really good production on the most recent Nicole Atkins record. But when they were with White Denim, this album, D, I think it probably has the best set of White Denim songs. And at this point, they kind of sounded a bit like Fish in the sense that they were this crunchy, almost like Woodstock-affiliated band, but at the same time, they had very much like a prog rock edge, which is almost sort of like a jam band crossed with something like Yes in terms of being able to do hairpin turns and turn on a dime and some really interesting time signatures. They actually, White Denim, with this formation of the band, put out a live record only on vinyl on Third Man Records back in 2011, which is just incredibly fiery. It's probably my favorite White Denim thing. So, well, I think they peaked in 2011. They're still a viable band today. They've got a completely different rhythm section than they used to have. But, no, they're still putting out good songs, good records. And I think Now that they finally had a chance to settle into their latest lineup, they should be on the upswing pretty soon.
Yeah, this record was huge in 2011. It did not make my list, but I definitely know all my friends who are in other parts of the country who I didn't see for an extended period of time when I lived in Portland because I, aforementioned, did not have any money. I feel like this record was like texted about more than probably any record in 2011. And it definitely was more of a grower for me, but I definitely hear it and I launched back into 2011. All right, so number six for me is Panda Bear's Tomboy. This is a record that kind of fits the mood for me in 2011 in that it's very atmospheric, borders on ambient, and also was a bit of a grower record for me that I didn't listen to as much in years following. I've come around to it actually strangely in the last 2 years. I've listened to it probably more than I ever did at any point in time, probably because I did not like Panda Bear's most recent record. It's the Grim Reaper, although he has a record that's coming out here in 2019. Probably has come out since we recorded this. But Tomboy was kind of the impossible follow-up as the work that Panda Bear had been associated with over the last 4 years was Person Pitch from 2007 that was absolutely brilliant. Animal Collective's Merryweather Post Pavilion from 2009 that I think if we were doing a list of the 2000s, that would be on probably both of our lists in our top 20s at least. And then Fall Be Kind was the EP that followed it up in late 2009. That just three records in a row that were standout, hugely influential, and Tomboy is very small. It's very one note at times. Like I said, it's grown on me a lot in the last couple of years. There's virtually no samples on it, which was really strange for Panda Bear listeners at the time. But yeah, so I definitely have come around a lot more on Tomboy at the time. It was number six for me, and I think that was kind of a fitting spot in the year.
So for number five, I have a band that no longer exists. That band is called Wild Beasts, and this is their third album called Smother. This was a very quiet, very, very emo British album. Often it kind of got compared to Spirit of Eden era Talk Talk. And while it wasn't nearly as freeform or kind of like distant or remote sounding as that album, certainly Smother was a delicate record. And while it used pop song like formats, it was a bit precious. I think the first time I heard it, I thought, okay, these guys are kind of pretentious and kind of silly. And granted, the first song on the album, Lion's Den, definitely is the most theatrical song and kind of not entirely reflective of the rest of the album. But this is a very lyrical, very kind of quiet, emotional album that while I haven't put it on recently, at the time they were almost garnering like Radiohead comparisons. So I think the album that came out after that was also pretty good. And then album number five, which was produced by John Congleton, who's like St. Vincent's producer. At that point, you thought, okay, these guys kind of have to hang it up. And then hang it up, they did. But this is something certainly worth revisiting if you are unfamiliar with it. It's Smother by Wild Beasts.
So my number five is Juliana Barwick's The Magic Place, which is, I don't know if this was her debut, but it was the first record I was introduced to with her. She's an ambient singer, songwriter, loops her voice and layers it in really unique ways. And, this came out in spring 2011. For those of you who have not been to the Pacific Northwest in the springtime, the result of the rain that comes throughout November, December, January, February, March, early April, there are these days where you get sunshine for the first time, in like 2 days back to back, and it's the greatest feeling in the world. And I've never seen any place greener. I've never seen any place that just like looks more alive than biking through even just like the neighborhoods in Portland at that time of year. And this record just perfectly complemented that. It's so peaceful. the cover is just it's like a smattering of leaves on a tree. It's like super green, super vibrant. And this was actually a record dedicated to a massive tree in front of her parents' farmhouse that she used to hide in and was called the Magic Place when she was growing up. It's just beautiful and really summarized a lot of where my head was at and where musically I was in early 2011. And she's released, I think, two or three records since then that are very much in the same formula as the Magic Place. Neither of them have hit me as hard as like songs like Envelope on this album, but really just gorgeous, very simple, like rewarding artist in terms of like the small changes that are made over the course of a 5-6 minute song.
I get her confused with Julia Holter. I know they toured together, right?
I was going to say, yeah, they tour together a lot. Okay. Julia Holter definitely writes more songs and is a bit more avant-garde. Juliana Barwick is, I don't know if they've ever recorded a song together, but they could complement each other in really fantastic ways if they ever did. But I would love to see a show of the two of them. That was a great bill that they did back in, I think it was 2013 was the last time they toured together.
So I've got for my number four, the album which Brian had previously talked about, Kurt Vile, Smoke Ring from My Halo. Still probably my favorite Kurt Vile album. This is the one that basically introduced me to Kurt Vile. I went back and fell in love with the Childish Prodigy album afterwards. But to me, this is my favorite Kurt Vile record because I know a lot of it was recorded on acoustic. I know when he plays these songs live, I think he does uses mostly electric guitar, but just the way it's really spare production. It's produced by John Agnello, who's an old school guy. I think he did some early engineering on some Springsteen records. Makes everything sound really good. And I just remember listening to this album sitting on a mega bus going to visit friends in Boston, especially the song On Tour, which is kind of about being on a bus or in a van, staring out the window and just trying to imagine myself being in like a touring band. But, you know, this has a lot of songs of his that I would consider classics, like the song Peeping Tomboy, the song Baby's Arms, which I think might have been used in a Citibank ad, but, you know, he's entitled to get that money. It's just, it doesn't have the rangy electric guitar jams that he would explore on like Waking on a Pretty Days and Believe Him Going Down, and even his most recent album Bottle It In. But I think it, like Brian said, it definitely pointed the way forward and kind of established him as a major artist to look for in the future. And his latest, Bottle It In, is fantastic. It's probably my favorite of his since Smoke Ring for My Halo. But back in 2011, I said, okay, this guy's going places. And clearly, I was right. So
my number four is from a kind of similar artist in that standpoint. And he made his record in 2011 that was my favorite of his until this year. And that's Cass McCombs with the record Wits End. I was past the Cass McCombs record Dropping the Writ in summer 2008 when I was living up in Alaska. And it was one of my favorite records. At the time, I think it was a 2007 release, but one of my favorite records from that part of the decade, Catacombs, that came out in 2009, was a huge record for me that year. And I greatly looked forward to this record, and it took me a very long time to get into it. It is a very slow, quiet, very contemplative album that once you get into it and once you kind of live in it for a little while, it is so rewarding. It's definitely the best record he made until that point in time, and definitely the best record he made until 2019. But there's some just Knock on Your Door, Buried Alive, Saturday Song. I mean, these are just really haunting. There's a lot of weirdness on this record. County Line is one of his best songs he's ever written. I went and saw him. I've seen him now 3 or 4 times. I saw him in 2011 on this tour. and he was great. The songs just came alive in the tour, and that was really what like clicked for me, how great the album was. And then I saw him in 2014, actually at the Empty Bottle in Chicago, and that was the first time I'd seen him really jam. And he jammed out some of the songs from this record. I mean, played him for like, you know, 10-12 minutes, and just hit me in a completely new way as well. So definitely love this record. This, I know we featured the song Buried Alive in episode 4, I want to say, the MSG Carini. Definitely one of my favorites that's held up over the last couple of years.
That was episode 4? Thought the MSG
episode 4,
episode,
yeah.
Carini was the E major, was the E minor stomp, right?
E minor stomp and songs about death and
okay,
dying,
all right.
Which Buried Alive very much is.
Right, because you played some evil E minor songs and death and dying. Okay, okay. Gotcha. All right.
Yeah.
So, my number three, much like my number three in 2010, kind of an album that's been lost to history a bit. This was the self-titled debut and I believe only album to date, and probably will be the only album, by Wild Flag, who are a supergroup of sorts, in the sense that Wild Flag featured Kerry Brownstein and Janet Weiss from Sleater-Kinney, as well as Mary Timoney, who was in the band Helium, and the band, more currently, she's in the band X-Hex, and has also done some solo work. I think it also had a keyboard player from the band The Minders, whose name escapes me at this moment. So when this came out, it was a big deal, because when Sleater-Kinney broke up in 2006 after putting out their incredible album, Woods, still my favorite favorite Sleater-Kinney album, Kerry Brownstein wasn't really playing guitar. I think she was doing things like blogging for NPR or I don't know exactly what. Portlandia hadn't happened yet, but she wasn't doing what she was put on this earth to do, which was completely shred the fuck out of her Rickenbacker and or Gibson SG. So when Wild Flag came around, it was kind of a big deal because you had, you know, Mary Timoney, who was a fantastic guitarist in her own right, joining forces with the Engine Room for Sleater-Kinney, Janet Weiss, and Kerry Brownstein. And it is a very good record. It's a really good, jagged, froggy power pop. I saw them play live twice. Each time they were kind of beset by some technical difficulties, but the performance was good. And when I say lost to history, it's because Sleater-Kinney came back. So when you compare Sleater-Kinney to Wild Flag, it's kind of like comparing Coca-Cola to Diet Coke, or comparing like Kentucky Fried Chicken gravy to Boston Market gravy. It's Wild Flag scratches an itch, but it ain't nothing like the real thing. So when Sleater-Kinney came out in 2015 with their fan-fucking-tastic album, No Cities to Love, Wild Flag kind of retreated to the background. But that's a good album. I actually put it on for the first time in a while in anticipation of doing this podcast, and it certainly holds up with some really good rock and roll.
So my number three scratched me in a totally new way. This is Leland Kirby's Eager to Tear Apart the Stars. This was like the culmination for me. I should say there's a record in, I believe it's 2013 when we get to there, that is the culmination for me of my ambient deep dive in the early 2010s. This is just a fascinating, just destructive, beautiful, apocalyptic record that I have not listened to in a long time, because it's not available at all on streaming services, but I listened to nonstop in the fall of 2011. And I ended up at my number three because at the time, an ambient record was going to end up at my number three 201 slot. This one was just a big hit for me throughout the year. Just kind of blew my mind as I biked through the city, as I recovered from 12-hour shifts learning to cook food, and cutting myself with cooking knives and burning myself on hot stoves and getting yelled at and getting pans thrown at me and living a life that was a lot harder than whatever I'm doing right now. And I definitely did not have nearly as much free time and needed something to just completely zone out and just kind of like go to space with. And this was just the record to do that with. And the album title, Eager to Tear Apart the Stars, just like fully matched what I was feeling and what I was hearing. And my favorite band at the time, you know, what they were doing, what Phish was doing at the time in terms of the Storage Jam, in terms of jams throughout the late summer 2011. So definitely a big record for me that I would love to hear again. I probably could just download it from some blog, but, you know, I'm stubborn like that.
You could download it from some random blog and infect your computer with spyware.
Exactly.
So don't do that. My number two album of 2011, Fucked Up, David Comes to Life. This is still the closest any band's ever come to making a melodic hardcore record that rivals Husker Du's Zen Arcade and New Day Rising. Basically, Fucked Up are like stadium hardcore in that they're kind of like a really aggro version of Foo Fighters with a barking hardcore vocalist in Damon Abraham, who takes his vocal inspiration from the 80s and early 90s Pacific Northwest hardcore band Poison Idea, who I think still kind of exists in some way, shape, or form. I think like the lead singer and just like a bunch of dudes still do Poison Idea. But anyhow, this album, I think it's a double record. It's like 75 minutes long. It has this crazy rock opera story about a factory worker named David who meets a girl named Veronica. Then the girl gets killed, and he spends the whole album like crying about it and wondering what went wrong. But none of that really matters because you can't understand the lyrics anyway. But it's got huge hooks. It's produced really well. It jumps out of your speakers. You will scream along. It is cathartic. There's some of the stuff you want to shout from the rooftops. And Damon Abraham is actually known from having a very interesting podcast as well called Turned Out a Punk, where he talks to various individuals about how they got into punk music. And his knowledge of punk and hardcore is extremely vast. So the albums that they put out since David Comes to Life, all of which have been good. This is still my favorite. I know they put out one a few months ago called Dose Your Dreams, which is very good. And they have a lot of Chinese Zodiac EPs. Like Fucked Up has like Year of the Dragon, Year of the Tiger, Year of the Snake, all of which tend to be more proggy as opposed to like hardcore music. Yeah, Fucked Up, David Comes to Life. Big throated melodic stadium hardcore record that makes you want to shout from the rooftops. Still listen to it today, would recommend it highly.
So my number two is a record I fully expect some sarcasm from Dave here about. This is Fleet Foxes' Helplessness Blues. Yeah, this just kind of tapped into everything sentimental and also nostalgic I was feeling during my 25th and 26th years on the planet. There's just a lot of kind of wondering and lost sense of youth throughout this record that I definitely felt at that point in my life, and from a career standpoint, from just kind of where I was at, and just really connected with this in a really profound way. I definitely like this more than what they put out in 2008. I listened to it again recently, and it's interesting because it's not quite yet as out there as Crack Up was, which I really liked from 2017. But you can definitely hear the band going that way, and I kind of wish that we had gotten, you know, that one or two more album evolution between Helplessness Blues and Crack Up, because we didn't hear from the band at all for the next 6 years. But I loved this record. I love the title track. I love probably the first half of the album. It's one of my favorite things recorded in 2011. Yeah, what were your thoughts on this?
I don't dislike Helplessness Blues, but I love the first Fleet Foxes record. But the second one, it just seems like the dude has gotten so into, like, caricature. Like, doesn't the title track have that verse where he's like, if I had an orchard, I'd work till I'm sore, and you would wait tables and soon run the store. I'm thinking, like, no one listens to this band actually knows how to, like, fucking farm. This is just... Fleet Foxes are selling, like, Pacific Northwest fantasies to like Williamsburg kids. That was
they certainly that is definitely true. I will not disagree with that at all.
Like, come on, you guys don't know how to like. If there was a world war and you guys had to grow your own Brussels sprouts, you couldn't do it.
There was definitely a lot of I want to be a farmer mentality when I lived in the Pacific Northwest that I have not heard in many other parts of the country. And yeah, this record definitely summarized that. I can see exactly what you're saying.
Yeah, I think I think when I wrote about that album, I said it reminded me of there's like a magazine you see in like restaurants called like Edible, and there's just like a bunch of like press releases compiled that you buy at like farm to table restaurants. And there's always like a pictorial of some guys got like an old timey mustache pouring like a $14 cocktail. That's kind of like the second Fleet Foxes record is a guy with an old timey mustache pouring a $14 cocktail. But they can harmonize. They should. There's not a lot of drums in that record. That record could use more forward propulsion.
Yeah, I think this was Father John Misty's last record playing drums for them.
My number one album is from Cut Copy. Album's called Zonoscope. Cut Copy are a fantastically fun dance band from Australia who kind of have a lot in common with Hot Chip, which you mentioned in the last episode. A little bit like LCD Sound System, although I think they sound more effortless than either of those bands. They draw from Erasure, they draw from New Order, they draw from Duran Duran. And to me, Zonoscope is their best album. It's their epic. It's got their longest songs. It's just one banger after another. I know a lot of people prefer the album that they put out in 2008 called In Ghost Colors. Again, like I'm fond of saying, I prefer Zonoscope. But if you wanted to argue that In Ghost Colors is better, I wouldn't think you were crazy. But just two back-to-back, extremely appealing dance pop records that kind of mining all the best aspects of all of my favorite dance rock bands like New Order, like Erasure. If you even want to go a bit further back, talk about Yaz, which is the band that eventually birthed Erasure. So yeah, again, an album that not a ton of people seem to talk about. When you hear about Cut Copy, you probably hear about the In Ghost Colors album. And the two albums that they put out since Zonoscope being Free Your Mind wasn't that great. More recently, Haiku from Zero, much better. But in terms of stadium, I guess, festival filling, disco ball, headlining, dance rock, I mean, Cut Copy Zonoscope is as good as it gets.
So my number one is another Retreat to the Wilderness record, one that has held up a ton for me. I listen to this record all the time still, and I love it. Bon Iver's self-titled record, Bon Iver. Coming off of Forever Ago, is that with his first album?
Yeah.
That was a huge hit in 2008. That record did not do very much for me at the time, though I've gone back and enjoyed it. I didn't have a ton of I don't know. I didn't really expect much from this record. I don't even think I listened to it for a couple of months after it came out. And I remember it hitting me really hard. There's a theme developing here with 2011 records of I was on my bike listening to this record for the first time. And I was biking through fall in Portland. And it just hit me on a thousand levels. And I loved the direction he took his music. I loved the synthesizers on the record. I love the what he's done with his voice. I love how like the songs just bleed into each other, and it's definitely one of those records that if I put it on, it's going on the entire way through. It's never really gonna like pause midway through it. It's great for driving. It's great for kind of late night hanging out, having a couple beers out on like a dock in Wisconsin, which I've listened to it in that environment multiple times. And it just really affected me in a heavy way in 2011, and it's continued for me here.
This was the one he put out after he became friends with Kanye, right?
Yeah, because he was on
Twisted Fantasy, like Lost in the World.
He was on Twisted Fantasy, and then and then this came out about 6 or 7 months after that came out.
Right, because I remember Twisted Fantasy there was a like intimate release show at the Bowery Barroom here in Manhattan that Bon Iver was at, and he was just this like goofy white guy on the stage trying to like keep up with Kanye and like dance. But this is Soul Title's a good record. It wouldn't be my top 10, but I definitely I'm not as big a Bon Iver fan as you are, but I appreciate that album as being very good.
Yeah, this is definitely my favorite of his, and you know, similar to Fleet Foxes, we didn't hear anything from him for 5 years. Late 2016 was when 22 Million came out, and I would have loved to have really heard the like subtle evolutions following this record, because he kind of crossed into a really unique plane of music, and I think it's great. The songs still hold up live, and you know, if you there's definitely a clear line for me from the National High Violet, that was one of my favorite record of 2010, to this record in 2011, that really kind of showcased this like singer songwriter. If you like kind of twist the sides of a song and kind of see what else is out there, it's definitely something I still listen to a lot.
And that's where our heads were at in 2011. So come back, there will be a future bonus episode in which we tackle 2012. That's coming up next. But until then, drink your carrot juice, eat your Wheaties, and be like Fleet Foxes and work in that orchard until your hands are sore. And then we will go beyond the pond.
Osiris.